Good morning and welcome to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm your host, Ty Bannerman. The 2020 census ends on September 30th, a full month earlier than previously announced. Nationally, about 15% of households have yet to be counted, and response rates are even lower in New Mexico, especially in rural areas and tribal communities where concerns about COVID-19 kept enumerators out for much of the summer. This morning, we'll hear how this final census push is going for some of New Mexico's hard-to-count populations and how an undercount could exacerbate racial and economic inequities in our state. And we want to hear from you. Have you completed your census? Tell us why you think it's important. Or have you yet to send in your form? What is holding you back? Are you an enumerator who goes door to door for folks who haven't completed their form yet? Tell us about your experience. Give us a call at 277-KUNM. That's 277-5866, and join the conversation. My first guests this morning are Atza Dawn Chavez, the executive director of the NAVA EP New Mexico Native Census Coalition, and Jamie Gloche, the coalition's Albuquerque Urban Indian Census Coordinator, as well as the Tribal Representative Subcommittee Chair for ICount New Mexico. Good morning, Atza and Jamie.
Good morning.
So, Atza, what is NAVA EP and how did it get involved in promoting the census?
NAVA Education Project is a 501c3 nonprofit who has been heavily engaged since the early 90s in uplifting Native American working families and trying to build a Native American voting bloc. So, when the census came around, knowing that those numbers have to do with redistricting, we engaged to make sure that we could get an accurate count across the state of New Mexico and tribal communities and urban areas.
So New Mexico's Native population is often underrepresented in U.S. census counts. Historically, why is that?
There are a number of reasons. First, I would say that there hasn't been a lot of effort put in to count Native Americans since the census began. There were many renditions of names for our population, as well as different ways of counting Native Americans across the United States. And then finally, I think a part of it has to do with a little bit of distrust for the government as a whole. Mm-hmm. I think if someone comes knocking on your door asking you to tell us who you are and how many people are in your household, it's a little intimidating when you're not sure who these folks are.
Certainly, as in a Native community, given the historically fraught relationship with the federal government, I'd imagine that plays a role too.
Yes, sir.
Okay, so can you tell me why it's so important then to get an accurate count in these communities?
There are a number of reasons why it is so important to get an accurate count. A lot of the federal funding that goes into communities happens based on the counts that you have within your community. So even though you may be in an urban area, if you identify as a member of a particular tribal community, then some additional resources go into those communities. And then also, it has a lot to do with your political representation. We have 6 House districts and 4 Senate districts in the state of New Mexico that are 50% or over Native American. And, you know, those make a difference in terms of making sure your voice is held and that you have the representatives across all levels of government. And so that plays a big role in terms of your voice and what community resources you have.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jamie, you work with the urban Native population. Is that population similarly underrepresented compared to the reservations and pueblos?
Absolutely. I think the majority of Native communities are underrepresented. In the 2010, it was estimated that we represent about 1 to 2% of the population. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes in data sets, we are othered or just completely not included because of that. So it's really interesting because we're seeing some demographic shifts as well with the urban Native population. And 2010 showed that like 78% of the Native population actually do live in urban communities now. Okay. Because of access to healthcare, mm-hmm. and infrastructure and schools and jobs, et cetera. But there's really not a way to encapsulate that and to know that and to direct resources to those communities.
Because if they're not represented, you mean?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. And so it's, you know, it's like we're a diaspora essentially. What's happening is I think it's crucial and critical for tribes to understand the data, not only locally so that they can access resources, but the urban population is often missed because we don't know where we are, or, you know, we don't know the exact count. And that's critical for counties as well as cities as they look to support the Native population or provide resources.
Now, can you talk about some of the challenges that are unique to counting the urban Native population?
Yeah, I think, you know, one, we're not necessarily in a specific geographic location, or we're all, like, for example, in Albuquerque, we're all throughout the city. But what's really hard to get that kind of data is it often is misconstrued. There was a Policy Link report about Albuquerque, about the inequities, and Native Americans in Albuquerque were represented in, you know, in a really negative light just because of the data that currently exists. And it said we were high in unemployment and, you know, all of these challenges. However, there wasn't any conclusive evidence about the need for housing. So it was mentioned like there was no actual housing need, which is really detrimental when you look at other point-in-time counts. For example, the New Mexico Coalition on Homelessness found that while Native Americans in the unsheltered community actually represent about 40% of that population.
Oh, wow.
So this is why data is so critical to, one, encapsulate and tell that story, but for us to, like, reclaim that narrative about our people and advocate for our people.
That makes sense. Now, working with the unsheltered Native population in Albuquerque, I'd imagine that is only made more difficult by the current situation with COVID-19 and the precautions people have to take.
Absolutely. I think, you know, one, nobody expected COVID, but this has been... It's totally exacerbated the systemic and historical inequities that have existed, not only in the unsheltered community, because we can't actually do outreach. Same in the Native communities on tribal lands, we can't do person-to-person outreach, and so a lot of it is done virtually. But a lot of unsheltered folks don't have access to the internet.
Right.
Same in tribal communities, there's a huge digital divide. So while the Census Bureau wants to push the self-response rates, people can't actually respond because they don't have adequate internet service. Additionally, the addressing system, same for unsheltered as well as tribal communities, there aren't, you know, they don't have like city-style addresses.
Right. So in the rural
of the communities. Yeah. And so much of the count requires that you connect a household with an actual physical location. Mm-hmm. So that has been really challenging.
I have a call here from Vaughn in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Good morning, Vaughn. What is your comment today?
Hi. How are you feeling this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing okay.
Okay.
I basically wanted to call in and bring attention to the Department of Human Resources. In the state departments, I want to bring a point that they're not doing a good job in counting people, being a part of the people, and helping the people, especially with basic testing and making sure that people have an address to be able to be counted.
Now, are you what kind of communities are you referring to?
Specifically, a lot of the eastern Colorado, where I escaped from, I would say. I had to basically escape from there because they were prosecuting me for just anything. And they wouldn't, I was able to allow my significant other and mother of my child to be able to be counted, just so she can claim an address.
So is she unsheltered?
You'll go ahead.
Is she unsheltered? Is she without a home?
No, she's sheltered.
Okay. So, but there was an issue with her having a physical address.
Being taken care of through foster system.
Oh, I see.
They are limiting anything. I don't understand why the Department of Human Resources isn't doing more to help during this pandemic.
I see. That's a good question. Well, thank you for your call, Vaughn. Getting back to this this question of addresses for unsheltered individuals, Jamie, that you were, as well as addresses in more rural areas. Can you explain to me how do you reach people who don't have a physical address?
Come around, you know, I think because no one expected COVID, as I previously stated, there were two operations that really tried to address that. One is the update leave, where enumerators would actually go out with the questionnaire and be on the ground and update the map that the Census Bureau has, the master address file, and then drop off the questionnaire and then ask the person, are there any other housing units that, you know, have since popped up since 2010? Unfortunately, because of COVID, a lot of the tribal communities shut down. So that operation was completely delayed. Mm-hmm. And the follow-up operation, which is called non-response follow-up, actually, if people do not respond online, if they do not use their questionnaire to respond, because that questionnaire has a unique identifier that matches the housing unit with the respondents. So the second operation is meant to kind of go in, same thing, on the ground, and go to the respondents' houses and get the questionnaire finalized. Because a lot of tribal communities closed down and because of the fear of COVID spread, and they weren't able to do that, and that's been significantly reduced in the timeline as well. We have until the end of September to do that. The original date that was told to us was October 31st.
That's right.
So communities are under significant distress now to make sure all of their people are counted, but have only barely slowly opened up on a phase approach because, you know, the concern was COVID and the spread of COVID. Mm-hmm. And when the Census Bureau was supposed to do these operations, you know, everybody in New Mexico was responding, but we were seeing at some point nearly 56% of those with COVID, you know, were representative Native populations.
Oh,
so
yes,
rightfully so, leadership and the communities were locking down and making sure, you know, that people were staying home.
Okay, and Atsa, I want to actually ask you a little bit about how you have adapted to this kind of this tough situation with COVID and communities being locked down. How do you change strategies to reach out to people when you know you can't go knock on their door?
Well, as Jamie had mentioned, because the tribes had used their sovereign right to close down their borders, we had preemptively tried to get as many of our tribal community members to apply for these census enumerator positions. However, due to COVID, there were a lot of complications with processing those particular applications. So in some communities, when they were able to open up for update leave, you know, there might be as few as one enumerator counting for the whole community. And so we've had to pivot every time the Census Bureau has changed their messaging. We did our best to stay with the strategy of asking people not to respond if they did not have that 12-digit code identifier, as Jamie had mentioned. But what that meant was that so many of our communities did not even start the count until June or July when these update leave forms were dropped off. So you're looking at these response rates being anywhere from, you know, a month and a half to 2.5 months of just efforts by our community members. We were fortunate to not have gone dark during these COVID times and continued to have our coalition meetings. And so this was the one way that our communities were continuing to prepare for these update leave forms being dropped off. And so when they did get dropped off, we saw anywhere from 10 to 25 points in response rate increases because of that. And so now in this last phase approach, you know, we have been inching up week by week. And had we been able to finish our counts in October 31st, as previously stated, being the end of the enumeration process, we would have gotten a lot of these communities to at least get to the numbers of 2010. Mm-hmm. That's not counting all of the births in that 10 years, but that's at least getting to that initial benchmark. But now, because we've been, the timeline has changed, there are actually a lot of Native communities and governance that are taking a stand. The Navajo Nation recently joined the lawsuit challenging the federal government's illegal shortening of the 2020 census. And we have a number of other communities who are very concerned because we use so much of these federal fundings to uplift these community, and without the ability to count everyone, we're shortchanging these communities as well as taking away our voice and representation politically.
Thank you, Atsa and Jamie. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Ty Bannerman. Do you have concerns about census workers coming to your door during COVID-19? We want to hear about your experience with the census this morning. The number is 277-5866, or you can tweet to us at hashtag Let's Talk NM. Call us at 277-5866 or email letstalk@kunm.org. We are going to take a quick break.
This piece by Maurice Ravel is an artful reflection of the uncertainty and anxiety that was heavy in the air after World War I, which in some ways also feels like a reflection of our times. We'll hear the beauty, the whimsy, and the unraveling of La Valse by Maurice Ravel on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Hi, my name is Katie Huska. I support, love, need KUNM because it is like the most community-oriented media format in my life. And the scope of programming for me is perfect. The variety, I listen to almost all of the programs, and I appreciate them all. So keep it up. Thanks very much for asking for my opinion.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are talking about the final push to complete the census by the end of the month. Do you use government programs like SNAP, Medicaid, or CHIP that rely on census data to allocate money? What would happen if funds for these programs changed due to an undercount? To join the conversation, give us a call at 277-5866. Joining us now, we have Kathy Lacey, the director of the U.S. Census Bureau's Denver Regional Office. She oversees operations in 12 states, including New Mexico. Good morning, Kathy. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. Now, we've heard from some local governments, including the Navajo Nation, that they are suing the federal government over this shortened census period. Is there a chance that we're going to see this census period extended again?
I would say no. However, you never know. I will tell you that from an operational standpoint, we are working towards and are on track to complete the census, this data collection phase, by September 30th. So really, it's right around the corner.
And now, you know, a lot of folks in New Mexico might be concerned about census workers approaching them during this time of COVID. What kind of precautions will workers be taking if they have to go door to door?
All right, we are going to look a little different. So number one, when we show up at your door, our employees should be wearing a mask. And when we knock on the door, we should be backing up to honor that 6-foot distancing. And this protects our staff as well as the public. We're pretty easy to spot because generally people have their Census Bureau bag with them, and they will have a handheld device. If people are not home, then we will leave what's called a notice of visit. Mm-hmm. So if people want to avoid that knock, on that notice of visit is a way that people can go online, or they can call and complete their census questionnaire right there.
Okay. So last year, the Trump administration attempted to put a question on the census that asked about citizenship status. That, of course, was blocked by the Supreme Court. But then this month, President Trump wrote a memorandum to remove the numbers of undocumented residents from the census count. What will this mean for the accuracy of the 2020 census?
It doesn't mean anything. We still have the same questions that were on the questionnaire that we are asking at the door. So our job has not changed. So we move forward, we implement what we had originally planned, and that's exactly what we're doing.
Okay. Now I have a question from Ellen in Albuquerque. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. I just wanted to, I'm curious on how are we going to get an accurate count when we've got people in the hospital with COVID, and then you've got, you know, that kind of thing? And then, so, like, how are they supposed to reach those people? Because you've got the homeless, but you've also got those people, like I said, who are in the hospital, and if they can't get to the, you know, if they can't mm-hmm. do what they need to do, how is that going to work because of that?
Yeah, that's a good question. Kathy, what about folks who are in the hospital or folks who are quarantining because they have been exposed to COVID and aren't supposed to have contact? How will that work?
Actually, she just really tapped into why the census is so complicated. There are various phases of the census. We actually have special operations that tap into counting those people who are in the hospital, identifying those that they have no other residence elsewhere, counting the homeless, identifying the service-based organizations. That operation is going to be coming up the end of September. So we tap into the service-based organizations. We tap into those people who are sleeping on the streets. We tap into those people who are staying in transitory locations. So that is why a census is so complicated, and we have mm-hmm. special operations to address those.
And what do those special operations look like for, say, people who are in the hospital?
Okay, so when we'll actually be working with the hospital administrators. In that case, they may be giving us information through electronic records that makes our job a lot easier. If they don't, and actually that's what we'll be doing, we'll mm-hmm. be working with the administrators to make sure we get people counted.
Now, will census enumerators be going through any kind of regular testing?
No, they do not go through regular testing.
Okay.
Now, we do have procedures. If someone is a COVID positive, then obviously they cannot work for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And that's actually worked pretty well for us. Even if they have a test, they're positive, and then they end up with a negative test, they are still quarantined for 14 days so that we make sure that person does not spread it to any of our offices or to any of our respondents. Mm-hmm.
So according to an internal census analysis that was leaked to the House Oversight and Reform Committee this month, because of this new September 30th deadline from the Trump administration, serious errors discovered in the data may not be fixed. What kind of serious errors are we talking about here?
I'm not sure exactly what they were referring to in that article. Mm-hmm. What I will tell you is that as far as, again, our field operations, we still have the same procedures that we have had in the past, and we have a certain level of accuracy for our field operations that we have to honor. And that means that as we go through, if we're not able to contact someone, it's a very, very small percent where we have no information. And that's where you go into those administrative records that will be used to, one, verify the information that we have, as like a double quality check. Mm-hmm. We also have our own team that goes behind us, and we do quality control actually during the process. So So we identify from a field perspective if there's anything. And then you have people who've self-responded. There are checks on that information just to make sure there's not anything funny in the data. Now, with this compressed time frame, the Census Bureau actually had to assure that they could do their normal quality checks during that process, and they're doing that right now as data's coming in.
Are they taking on extra employees, or how are they addressing this this increased, you know, the decreased time frame in terms of internally?
Okay, so I can only say from a field implementation standpoint, we are continuing to hire. We are continuing to hire, continuing to train, and putting people out into the field so we can meet that deadline. And the deadline for turning over the apportionment counts to the President and Congress, that's actually the end of this year, so December 31st, 2020.
Okay, and some people... maybe those who are in a mixed status family where one of the family members is undocumented or something like that may be worried about what the federal government is going to do with their census data, especially with the current administration's history of anti-immigrant rhetoric. How can folks be sure that their data won't be used against them?
One, all the information that we collect is protected under Title 13 of the U.S. Code. And what that means is that we cannot release individual responses to any census questionnaires to anyone. If people want to know what that looks like, you can go on to census.gov and actually look at, we only release information in statistical format so that it does not identify individuals. Mm-hmm. And this new big data world actually will probably be releasing information at a not as low a level as we have in the past to make sure that we are honoring the confidentiality of every response. And, you know, it's really important for us to say that every person who lives here, they're to be counted with the census. We're not asking about citizenship, as you said before. Mm-hmm. It's not on our questionnaire, and our responsibility is to count everybody. So we do need people to cooperate with our census workers or to go online or call.
Okay, well, thank you so much for talking to us this morning, Kathy. I hope everything goes well from this point forward.
All right, thank you so much.
Certainly. Now I'd like to welcome Pamela Herndon, the CEO of the KHW Law Center and the first vice president of the NAACP of Albuquerque. Good morning, Pamela.
Well, good morning, Ty. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning, and that's KWH Law Center.
Oh, I'm sorry. I transcribed it incorrectly. Well, thank you for calling in, or thank you for speaking to us. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. So the Albuquerque chapter of the NAACP has partnered with Albuquerque Public Schools and the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority on working toward a complete census count in Bernalillo County. Why are these organizations interested in making sure we have an accurate picture of the population in Bernalillo County?
Well, if we look specifically at Albuquerque Public Schools, their interest would be in making sure that students who don't otherwise have access maybe to resources such as food at home, for example, or even for health care, because what the census data will show and then produce in terms of finances is the opportunity for those students to have free lunches at school and also to have access to children's health care. And what happens when school is not in place is that those students and the parents of those students have access to things called grab-and-go lunches, and they have access to what's known as a food pantry, because we always want to make sure that students are healthy and are able to eat and to be viable. And so with respect to Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority, so that is a national sorority, but of course here in the state of New Mexico, they focus on making sure that the well-being of all of the individuals within our state are lifted by ensuring that they are also having access to housing and to health care, and also to make sure that whenever it's needed, developing adult education programs to make sure that adults are pursuing and advancing their lives in the manner in which they'd like to.
So lots of programs are dependent on this data being accurate.
Absolutely.
So tell me about this partnership. Obviously, everything changed with COVID-19. I'd imagine that the partnership strategy for getting a complete count had to adapt to the situation. What sort of changes in strategy has the partnership made because of the precautions necessary?
With respect to looking at how we partnered with Albuquerque Public Schools, one of the things that I think people don't realize is the school system has something, a group called Community School Coordinators, mm-hmm. and they have very strong ties to the families within the schools where they are assigned to make sure that those students and those and the parents are doing well. And so what we do is make sure that we utilize those community school coordinators to talk directly to the parents and to the students about getting engaged. Mm-hmm. And so rather than having an outside conversation trying to call these individuals, there was a trusted voice that was speaking to them. And you know what, Ty? I really want to raise the voices of people like Melanie Lewis and Andrew Brayman, who are community school coordinators, who have been incredibly engaged in mm-hmm. helping to make sure that families are counted. And so when those trusted voices called individual families and said, will you please make sure that you're completing the census, they actually responded. And what we did as a method of saying thank you and also recognizing that we would be helping in many times Title I families and low-income families is providing them with gift cards to places like Walmart or other locations that could help them. Mm-hmm. And so the other things that we did in terms of strategy and pivoting, because we did not have direct contact with individuals, we've been using the billboards, and you can see them all around Bernalillo County right now. Everywhere you drive, you walk, you look, and we've been totally trying to make sure that those billboards are entrenched in communities where there's typically a low response rate. Mm-hmm. And then we also have pivoted to engage phone banking in those areas where we were just calling individuals. They did not necessarily have kids in school, but we wanted to talk to them directly and say, you know, it's so important to you and it's important to our city and our state for you to get counted in the census, so that there was a direct conversation mm-hmm. and people could have a direct connection with respect to the census. So those areas worked. And then if nothing else, we used familiar faces like our Congresswoman Deb Holland on census postcards that we sent out to say, with a message from her, get counted in the census because we are depending upon you. So it was those direct types of outreach that we utilized to make sure and to that people were engaged.
Now, when you use someone like Deb Holland, are there concerns about it being seen as a sort of a campaign promotion, or how does that work?
So we made specific, let me go back. We were specifically pointed about that. We had her, and she did check with the Ethics Committee. Mm-hmm. We did not put anything on there to indicate that she was a running for office or had any type of political outreach whatsoever. The message on the cards only direct and are directly associated with census information and with getting people counted in the census. Because we have to remember, although these individuals may be political figures as we see them, they are also very humane individuals who care about the communities where they live. And their trusted voices are also important for making sure that there's a conversation with the communities that they serve.
So it's really just about getting recognizable folks and people who are, you know, engaged.
That is absolutely correct. It is all about getting recognizable people. And again, the term, those trusted voices that people will recognize and respect and say, oh, well, I hear this from a very trusted voice that I should get engaged and counted in the census, and people will respond in that regard.
Okay, you are listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. Do you worry that what the federal government, how it might misuse your census data? What questions do you have about how the census works? Call us at 277-5866. Tweet to us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM or email letstalk@KUNM.org. We will be back in a moment.
If KUNM strikes a special chord with you, donate that old accord to keep the tunes coming. Turn your Beetle into the Beatles. Turn your Altima into the ultimate in great music. Have a Buick Century from the last century, donate it to us in this century. We accept just about anything with wheels and an engine. To find out if your car qualifies, call 888-KUNM-CAR. It just takes a few minutes. That's 888-KUNM-CAR or 888-586-6227.
Native ceremony is an important part of our tribal nations. National health officials recommend tribal leaders consider canceling or postponing them until the pandemic is contained. Join us as we talk with spiritual leaders about the difficult choices around ceremonies. That's on the next Native America Calling.
Weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
This is Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Ty Bannerman. We are talking about the final month of census counting and why it's important. I am speaking to Pamela Herndon, the first vice president of the NAACP in Albuquerque. Now, Pamela, I understand that part of your outreach efforts to get a complete count of Bernalillo County includes creating T-shirts that read, and correct me if I have this wrong, what if we are more than 3%? What is that referring to?
That's absolutely right, Ty. So with respect to the African-American population in New Mexico, generally the count over the past few years has shown that African-Americans only comprise about 3% of the population of the state. But what if the count was absolutely accurate and those numbers were higher than 3%? Mm-hmm. So that's what the conversation was all about. Because if there was an indication that the count was higher than 3%, then those resources that would be available to the African-American community could be expanded. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if we look at something like healthcare and sickle cell anemia, which is primarily focused on African-Americans, the access to looking at that disease and healthcare with respect to that population could be expanded within our state because we would recognize that, look, we have more than 3% of our population. Maybe we have 10% of the population that is comprised of African Americans, and we really do need to make sure that we have the resources to address their needs. So that's what that's all about. And I think that that conversation has also been resonating within the African-American population.
Now, is the African-American population considered one of the hard-to-count communities?
It is. It is absolutely considered one of the hard-to-count populations, as are most of the communities of color, Hispanic populations, our Native American populations. And, you know, what has happened over the years, Ty, is there's been a reticence, not necessarily a trusting of what would happen with respect to data that may be provided with the government. I mean, if you look at what happened with African Americans over the years, they've been tested and utilized as test instruments. And the same thing with Native Americans and with Hispanic Americans. Like, they were saying, well, how do we know this is not going to lead to something that we don't want to have happen? Mm-hmm. So those have been some of the problems that have been arising with respect to the engagement with communities. It's just that lack of trust with respect to the governmental officials that may be in place right now. Mm-hmm. And we really do have to tell them, as I think your previous guest said, that data is not turned over to anybody, and it's absolutely protected.
It's locked down for a period of, I think, 70 years as far as, like, personal data. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining us this morning, Pamela. Now, I'd like to bring in two more guests. I've got Carolina Romero, the Programmatic Outreach Liaison for Catholic Charities, and Mohammed Ismail, who works in the Albuquerque Public Schools Refugee and Newcomer Support Program. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Ty. Thank you for having us in.
Certainly. And it looks like we may have actually lost Mohammed. Hopefully we'll be able to get him back on the line. So, Carolina, you are working closely to ensure a complete count of Albuquerque's refugee population. Do you have a ballpark on how large that population is?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the numbers, you know, of the whole population of the immigrants here, it's about 60 to 90,000 in Albuquerque.
60 to 90,000.
Yeah, and about 35% are like foreign born. They've been here since the 1990s. But, you know, the number of the population, you know, there's, you know, it's a mix of people from China and Philippines and Vietnamese are the majority of it. But the ones that have been coming to Albuquerque as refugees, you know, recently it's been more people from Afghanistan and Syria and Iraq and a lot of countries in Africa as well. I don't have a, like a specific number for it right now, and I think that's the main challenge for us, you know, is looking at even like how do you find that data? You know, there's a lot of math about hard-to-count communities in Albuquerque that we're working with. But for specific languages, it's out throughout the city that people are in. So it's harder to even identify where they are. So basically working with Mohammed at APS and also the clients that Catholic Charities already have, we kind of know of the zip codes where people live. But it's basically throughout the city that the population is lives. So the work really is more based on the community where we reach out to community leaders and they are helping us with phone calls for the census. And we are doing a lot of outreach with international stores that sell products for the community as well.
And now it looks like we do have Mohammed on the line. Good morning, Mohammed.
Good morning, Ty. This is Mohammed. Thank you for having me.
Certainly. Thank you for joining us. Now, you are a newcomer yourself, having arrived in the U.S. from Afghanistan only a few years ago. How did you get involved in census outreach?
Yes, Ty. Thank you. And I moved here 6 years ago, and so I was able to speak the language, and I work for APS and educate my community on navigating the system and accessing the resources. So this was a good opportunity for me to learn myself about census because it's my first time doing it as well, and an opportunity to teach and spread awareness to the community on the importance of the census and what will happen when you get counted and what is the outcome if you don't get counted. So then I partnered with Carolina Catholic Charities, and they offered me to help them as a volunteer to outreach to the community, make phone calls, and educate and encourage people to do their census and make sure they are counted so we don't lose the resources from the federal government. And that's how I got involved in this project, and I'm glad that I'm part of this.
Yes, absolutely. And Mohammed, so what are some of the challenges in promoting the census among your community?
The challenges are like language barrier, computer skills. So most of our community members, they don't speak the language. That is a challenge. So we have created videos in Dari and Pashto. We have also created videos in Arabic, which I help because I don't speak that language. But we have created videos of explaining the importance of census and also how to fill out your census. Because I'm not a numerator, I can't help them actually fill census, but I did a video explaining how to do it in Dari and Pashto.
And
also outreach.
So, Dari and Pashto, are there census forms available in either of these languages?
Yeah, the census forms are unfortunately not available in these languages. But partnering with Catholic Charities, I have translated a guide, which is not available in Census Bureau's languages, in Pashto and also in Dari. So, unfortunately, those languages are not included in the actual census forms.
Now, Carolina, when there are languages that aren't included in the census forms, if you don't have somebody like Mohammed who can provide a guide in that language, how can people be expected to fill out their census if they can't read the materials?
the major challenge, because, I mean, if the census have 10 years to put this together, why not having every language that people in that live in the United States speak? I think that's a big question to the Census Bureau, right? The argument is we can't do it for every language because of the size of the population, so we do to the main languages. But then that's exactly why we have hard-to-count communities where we cannot assist them if they don't understand what it says in English. But I think, Ty, it goes back to something a little bit different. You know, when you talk to some communities hard to count already in the U.S., they understand what the census is, right? A lot of people that are refugees that came here, you know, less than 10 years ago, they don't have that concept. They don't understand what that means, understanding that there's a mandatory answer that you should have and that will reflect in assistance and funds for your kids, school, for your hospitals and for roads. So it is a foreign concept.
So that people don't necessarily come from countries that have a census. So even the ideas is difficult.
Yeah. So I think it's more like an education process where you like to, you know, so for example, Catholic Charities, before the quarantine in February, we have a parent engagement group of 60 parents that speak Swahili, Arabic, Dari, Farsi, and Pashto. And, you know, we had a conversation about what census was and asking, you know, do you understand what this concept is? And, you know, is there anything similar in your country? Because I think it's, you know, assuming that people understand what census is, it's just a mistake right there that we need to actually start educating people to understand. So I think, you know, foreign-born that, you know, recently arrived, and also, you know, having the idea of someone knocking your door is also another hard concept that, you know, like answering questions to people that come in to knock.
Are there trust issues at play there where people are hesitant to participate in the census because they in this community because they fear what the government might do with that data?
Yeah, that is. I mean, I think it's different that other immigration groups, you know, the refugees come to the United States with a green card, basically, and they can work here. But, you know, the language is the barrier, the first barrier, right? So, for example, you know, when we were starting doing this campaign, we had got, you know, APS classrooms and other community centers where we could invite the community to come and sit down with them, the computer, and teach them how to do this. You know, unfortunately, with the COVID, this didn't happen. But even, like, understanding why do I have to do this, you know, it's a main question. So, and, you know, giving my kids birth date, you know, so I think there's a lot of questions about all of this, you know, and definitely the whole issue about the citizenship question, it is something that came out
the
all the time when we were doing
question.
The training with the community.
What were some of the concerns about hearing this rhetoric about the citizenship question among the community?
You know, they're afraid of doing something wrong, right? Like, so if you you're not sitting and you vote, for example, because it has happened to communities that don't understand, you know, what it is. I have a driver's license, I think I can vote, right? So that is all these questions, like, I don't want to do anything wrong that's going to hurt me later. And I think bringing that up brought fear to a lot of people. So it's a question of, like, you know, is it going to hurt me if I'm trying to apply for citizenship? I think that was a lot of that question that came about when we were doing the training with the community.
So, you know, as we've been talking about all morning, COVID-19 has really made all of these things harder to do. How did you change your outreach methods in light of the pandemic?
Yeah, so we had over like 30 events scheduled. So basically, we have a Catholic Charities community, bilingual community liaisons, and that speak Arabic, Swahili, and Dari and Pashto. And we created like videos of like, we wanted to teach you how to use your cell phone to answer the census. So we did instruction videos of like, you know, how to go online, how to go to the census, and teaching people one-on-one. So basically a lot of phone calls, like people were unable to do it on the phone by themselves. So like, you know, can you ask some your kids to sit down with you to help you? We start doing Zoom calls, WhatsApp groups to explain and send those videos that Muhammad mentioned to the community. But, you know, we are happy that like all of the communities that we work with directly have done the census. And the idea was for them to talk to their family and friends to do it the same as well. We created campaigns with raffles. Currently, we have like gift certificates in for small businesses here in Albuquerque that people can show their confirmation numbers from the census and get these incentives. The idea is really like making sure that they actually confirm and finalize and submit the census. I think there's a lot of fear, like, you know, what if I'm doing this questionnaire and I can't send it? What's going to happen to me?
Right.
You know, in theory, through the Constitution, there is supposed to be a fine if you don't do the census that nobody talks about much. But, you know, it's just part of the Constitution's mandatory thing to do. So we worked a lot on explaining that as your civic duty to do it and how that is going to benefit your family.
Okay. Now, Mohammed, I'd like to, you work, of course, with Albuquerque Public Schools. How has APS been working to promote the census among this population?
So what we do is with hard-to-reach community, especially my community who speaks Dari and Pashto, whenever we do advocate for them or we call them on important school matters, like telling them about resources, how this online learning, virtual learning will look like, and where you can get resources, food, and all that, then we remind them of census. We ask them a basic question at the end of the conversation. Did you get, did you complete your census? Do you have any question about your census? And giving them the information of the confidentiality that when you provide this information to the government, it's all confidential. And it's only used for census purposes. And it will not be shared to any government entities. And those are, and also, when I'm working with Catholic Charities Carolina to outreach families, then we do individual calls to the families, and the estimated numbers we call is around 130 students that we have speaks Dari and Farsi, and then we have around 16 numbers. These are estimated numbers, but 16 students who speak Pashto. So we call them and remind them also of like which complete census, and it's very important that you do, because based on the numbers and census, we get resources from the federal government. So it will help not just you, me, it will help everyone in the community.
Are there technology issues sometimes with these families, like learning how to use the system?
Absolutely. There's a lot of issues, like as I mentioned, about computer skills. So they might not be able to access a computer, open Google, but... I have encouraged them to find someone in their family that who is a little bit literate about computer or have computer skills or who can read and write English. And I have sent them the videos through WhatsApp or email or Facebook, so they can watch the video, and based on their video, if they have any questions, they can call me. But based on their video, they can complete their census. So absolutely, language, computer skills are the main challenge that we face in outreach.
Okay, well, thank you both, Mohammed and Carolina Romero. That is all the time that we have today. Thanks to everyone who called in to share your thoughts. Thanks so much to our guests. Let's keep this conversation going. Share your thoughts on Twitter, hashtag Let's Talk NM. On Facebook, search for KUNM Radio, or email letstalk@KUNM.org. If you missed part of the show, stream it online or subscribe to our podcast. You can find that wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Megan Kamrick screened your calls. Taylor Velasquez live tweeted the show today. Hannah Colton, our news director, produced the show. I'm Ty Bannerman. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.